السلام عليكم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين والعاقبة للمتقين ولا عقبال إلا على الظالمين. وأفضل الصلاة وأتم التسليم على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين. رضي الله عن أصحاب المنتجبين المخلصين والتعبين لهم خير وإحسان إلى يوم الدين وعلى بعض. Brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Assalamu alaikum. My name is, for those of you who don't know me, my name is Dawood Waleed. I'm the Executive Director of the Michigan Chapter of CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, and I will be moderating this important and timely panel on Islamophobia. What we will do, God willing, is we will have two presentations by our distinguished speakers, which will be about 20-30 minutes in time period. And then perhaps I will ask a follow-up question or two to one of them regarding what they presented, just for clarification or to flesh out a couple of things. And then, inshallah, we will then open up the floor for any questions and brief comments. No khutbah muhadara in the audience, because I know how Muslims can get. You say, okay, ask the question, and then you want to get 5 minutes, or so we're going to cut that short. But then very brief questions or comments to our two distinguished speakers. So without any further ado, I'd like to call up Brother John for the first presentation.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. والصلاة والسلام على أشرف المرسلين محمد الأمين سيدنا وحبيبنا ونبينا وعلى آله الطيبين والطاهرين إلى يوم الدين. I take refuge in Allah from Satan the rejected, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Praise be to Allah, the Lord of the worlds. May peace and blessings be upon the best of the messengers of Allah, Muhammad the truthful and the trustworthy, our beloved Lord and Prophet, and upon his family, the good, the pure, until the day of judgment. I send you greetings of peace. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It is a blessing, a privilege, and an honor to speak at the 2016 Muslim Congress on a subject that impacts us all, Islamophobia. The dislike of Islam and Muslims, the prejudice against Islam and Muslims, the fear and hatred against Islam and Muslims. I wish I could tell you that everyone loved us. Unfortunately, a hell of a lot of people hate us. Although we have hit rock bottom, and our popularity rating is in the pits, we should not despair. We should view this as an opportunity and challenge, as well as a test and a trial. When you are down, the only way is up. However, rest assured that although we are in the darkest part of the night, the dawn will come and the sun will rise. As followers of Ahl al-Bayt, I am sure you know what I mean and who I mean when I speak of the sun behind the clouds. I speak of the light of Islam, the axis of the universe, and the Imam of the age, Salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Rest assured, we are not alone. Allah is with us, Rasulullah is with us, the A'imah are with us, and the Malaika are with us. Consider these our Meccan days, our period of persecution, and a period of sadness and tears. Do not despair, do not lose faith. Almighty Allah has promised us victory in both this world and the hereafter. Verily, we will be triumphant. During this age of intolerance and ignorance, in which Islam and Muslims are victimized and demonized in generalized fashion, we should not feel helpless and hopeless. There are many things that we can do and that we must do for our sake, the sake of Islam, the sake of Muslims, and the sake of humanity as a whole. First and foremost, we must teach Muslims to truly represent Islam. One of the most effective ways of combating Islamophobia is to show non-Muslims that the things that they hate and fear about Islam and Muslims have nothing to do with Islam. As Imam Ali alayhi salam has said, people are enemies of what they don't know. If Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, the recently rebranded Al-Nusra, Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, and ISIS represent Islam, the people have every right to hate Islam. If the Salafi Jihadis, the Wahhabis, the Khawarij, the Najdis, the Nawasib, and the Takfiris are Muslims, the people have every right to hate Muslims. In reality, Islam and Muslims are the target of a massive campaign of negative marketing on a global scale. Efforts to distort Islam and to dehumanize Muslims date back to medieval times. These efforts intensified during colonial times. However, nothing can be compared to the all-encompassing propaganda that has been polluting the planet for the past few decades. Billions upon billions of dollars have been spent to portray Muslims as terrorists and savages who threaten civilization as a whole. While our resources are limited, we must fight ignorance with knowledge. We must fight misinformation with information. We must fight propaganda with facts. We must fight falsehood with truth. We must fight fake Islam with true Islam. How then should we proceed? In order to combat Islamophobia, we must combat extremism and terrorism ideologically, informationally, and religiously. On the ideological front, we have an immense challenge. There are approximately 100,000 Takfiri terrorists. 7% of self-professed Muslims support them. However, the number is significantly higher when we ask Muslims whether they share the same ideology. The Takfiri ideology could never have spread without an immense and widespread ignorance of the depth and greatness of the Islamic social, intellectual, and spiritual tradition. An ignorance that is traceable back to the destruction of the traditional Muslim educational system under Western colonialism. Islam must get beyond the barren dialectic between the liberal modernizers who attempt to take various secular forms of social organization as models in order to bring Islam into the 21st century by a process of voluntary recolonization, and the blind and violent reactionaries who wish to return Islam to its so-called original purity. The only alternative to this poisonous dichotomy is to rediscover these supremely just, intelligent, and humane forms of social organization established by the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, in his covenants, his treaties, and in the constitution of Medina. Within these documents can be found the fertile seed of a universal declaration of human rights that owes nothing to the atheistic ideologies of the West. One capable of growing into a great tree, providing shelter to the nations, a tree directly springing from the soil of Islam. If, however, Islam fails to dedicate itself to recovering its greatness, not so much the greatness of its past, but the greatness of its essence, then Daesh and its various littermates will occupy the burned-out heart of our religion, and Islam will be destroyed. On the information front, every effort must be made to make the world's population aware of the many actions presently undertaken by Muslims, from both the governmental and private sectors against ISIS and other Takfiris, while at the same time providing expanded opportunities for public participation in these actions. Unless the war of information is won, the war between a true Islam and fake Islam for the hearts and minds of the Ummah, Islam will be destroyed. As for the religious front, it cannot be limited to the ideological sphere. It should certainly include the establishment of ongoing diplomatic liaisons with the leaderships of the non-Muslim religions presently being persecuted by Daesh, for purposes of developing a common strategy to defeat them. The central strategy and tactic on the religious front, however, must be to make fervent du'as to Allah to implore His guidance in the war against His enemies. It was not you who threw when you threw, but God through. If we do not put Allah first, if we do not exalt His will and His agenda over whatever strategies and agendas we may decide upon, then it will not matter if Islam is destroyed, because it will be dead already. In our collective struggle against Islamophobia, in our fight against extremism and terrorism, please allow me to propose a few concrete steps that any ordinary Muslim may take. Spread Islam. Spread traditional civilizational Islam. Spread non-sectarian Islam. Spread an inclusive Islam. An Islam of diversity, tolerance, love, mercy, and justice. Spread it by word and spread it by action. Put Islamic morals and ethics into practice. Fight fake Islam with true Islam. Compare and contrast. Present a verse from the Quran and then contrast it with the actions of extremists. Present a hadith from the Prophet and then contrast it with the actions of extremists, thus delegitimizing their discourse. Disseminate the constitution of Medina. Islamists claim that they wish to create an Islamic state. However, they ignore the fact that the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, produced the first political constitution in the history of humanity, an inclusive and pluralistic political charter that granted equality to all citizens regardless of religion, race, or gender. From day one, the Ummah of Islam was composed of Muslims and non-Muslims. The Prophet, his companions, and his holy household all respected the people of the book who were friends and allies of the Muslims. They were one Ummah, united on universal and primordial principles. Disseminate the covenants and treaties that the Prophet Muhammad concluded with Christian, Jewish, and Zoroastrian communities. These include the Treaty of Makna, the Treaty of Ayla, the Treaty of Najran, the covenant with the monks of Mount Sinai, the covenant with the Christians of Persia, the covenant with the Assyrian Christians, the covenant with the Armenian Christians, the covenant with the Coptic Christians, and the covenant with the Parsis. Disseminate the covenants that the caliphs and sultans concluded with non-Muslim communities. These include the covenant of Abu Bakr, the covenant of Umar, the covenant of Ali, the covenant of Salahuddin, and the covenant of Sultan Mehmet with the Christians. Pressure leaders in the Muslim world to protect Christian minorities from persecution. Demand that Muslim minorities around the world receive the same protections. Join or organize demonstrations calling for the protection of persecuted Muslims and Christians. Join or organize demonstrations calling for the protection of sacred sites and places of worship, as Christian, Sunni, Shiite, and Sufi spaces are the preferred targets of Takfiri terrorists. Denounce any government, Muslim or non-Muslim, who supports directly or indirectly Takfiri terrorists who persecute Christians, Sunnis, Shiites, and Sufis. Oppose foreign interference in our Islamic affairs in the Western world. Denounce religious colonialism. Mosques and Muslim organizations in the West should be concerned about the interests of Western Muslims and should not serve the strategic plans of any so-called Muslim country. When people slander Islam, the Quran and the Prophet, point them to the covenants of the Prophet Muhammad and let Muhammad ibn Abdullah, peace and blessings be upon him, speak for himself. Share the covenants of the Prophet with the people of the book in word and action. Build bridges of understanding between all believers. Volunteer your time and your skills. We need translators. We need people with expertise in business, marketing, advertising, social media. Everyone has something to offer. If you cannot donate your time, donate your money. Support the Covenants Initiative or other efforts. Give sadaqah, give zakat, give khums. Familiarize Muslims and non-Muslims with all the initiatives against extremism and radicalization, efforts that are deliberately unreported or underreported for political purposes. They include ISNA's Muslim Code of Honor. Signed in September 2007, it denounces extremism and violence, calls for Islamic unity between all believers, and prohibits takfir or excommunication. Number two, a common word between us and you. This open letter, which was jointly composed by Muslim and Christian leaders, was released in 2007. It calls for peace between both major world religions and encourages them to work for common good, for common grounds. A common word has been critical in fostering interfaith dialogue. shoulder to shoulder since 2010. The Islamic Society of North America has joined with 27 national faith-based interfaith organizations to address anti-Muslim sentiments in the United States. The fatwa against terrorism and suicide bombing. It was issued by Dr. Muhammad Tahir al-Qadri in 2010. It states that terrorism is terrorism, violence is violence, and it has no place in Islamic teachings, and no justification could be provided for it. The Covenants of the Prophet Muhammad with the Christians of the World. This book, which I published in 2013, consists of a study of the treaties that the Messenger of Allah made with the people of the book. It features long forgotten documents, some of which I rediscovered in ancient monasteries and archives, and which I translated from Arabic into English. The Covenants of the Prophet Muhammad prove that he was committed to creating an inclusive, pluralistic community of believers. The Prophet explicitly stated that Muslims are required to protect religious sites and institutions, not destroy them. As the Messenger of Allah commands us in his covenants, وَلَا تُغَيِّرْ أُسْقُفْ أَنُسْقُفِيَّ وَلَا رَاهِبْ مِنْ رَحْبَانِيَّ وَلَا نَصْرَانِ مِنْ نَصْرَانِيَّ وَلَا رَاهِبْ مِنْ سَوْمَعَتِهِ وَلَا سَايَحْ مِنْ سِيَاحَتِهِ وَلَا يُحْرَمُ بَيْتٍ بُيُوكَ نَاسِهِمْ وَبَيْهِمْ وَلَا يَدْخُلُ شَيْءٍ مِنْ نَدَازِلِهِمْ فِي شَيْءٍ مِنَ الْمَسَاجِدِ وَلَا مَنَازِلِ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ الْمُسْلِمِينَ فَمَنْ فَعَلَ ذَلِكَ فَقَدْ نَقَضَ أَحَدَ اللَّهِ وَخَلَفَ رَسُولُ اللَّهِ وَخَائِنْ ذِبَةَ اللَّهِ. It is not permitted to remove a bishop from his bishopric, or a Christian from his Christianity, a monk from his monastery, or a pilgrim from his pilgrimage, or a hermit from his tower. Nor is it permitted to destroy any part of their churches, to take parts of their buildings to construct mosques or the homes of Muslims. Whoever does such a thing will have violated the covenant of Allah, disobeyed the Messenger of Allah, and deviated from his divine alliance. The covenant of the date from the second year of the Hijra to the final years. The covenant states from the second year of the establishment of the Muslim community in Medina to the final years of his life, demonstrating that they represented permanent policy. The documents state that they are binding upon Muslims until the end of times, and some include a stern warning. وَمَنْ ظَلَمَ بَعْدَ ذَلِكَ دِنِيًا وَنَقَدَ الْأَحَدْ وَرَفَدَهُ كُنْتُ كَسْمَهُ يَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ مِنْ جَمْيَ الْمُسْلِمِينَ كَفَتًا. Whoever is unjust after this towards a Christian subject, breaks the covenant and rejects it, I will be his enemy on the day of judgment among all Muslims. The Covenants Initiative, inspired by the covenants of the Prophet Muhammad with the Christians of the World, created the Covenants Initiative, an international movement committed to protecting persecuted Jews, Christians, and Muslims. The Covenants Initiative, which calls upon Muslims to renew their oath to the Prophet Muhammad and abide by the treaties that he concluded with the people of the book, has been signed by several hundred leading Sunni, Shi'i, and Sufi scholars, academics, and activists. Bin Baya passed the fatwa denouncing ISIS. The letter to Baghdadi was signed by over 100 of Islam's leading scholars and directed personally to the leader of the pseudo-Islamic state. There is also the Annan message, the statement from the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the fatwa from Al-Azhar, the statement from the Arab League, the fatwa from the Mufti of Turkey, the condemnation of ISIS by CAIR, the declaration by the Muslim Council of Great Britain, the fatwa from the Fiqh Council of North America, the joint Sunni-Shia fatwa issued by 100 UK imams, the statement by the Muslim Public Affairs Committee, the campaign of NU, the largest Islamic organization in the world, representing 50 million Indonesians, the statements of Sheikh Mohammed Al-Yaqubi, the jihad declared by the Muslim youth group in the UK, the historic Islamic edict or fatwa on joining ISIL, passed by the Islamic Supreme Council of Canada, the mass fatwa against ISIS. In December of 2015, 70,000 Muslim clerics from India signed a joint fatwa against ISIS. You have the denunciations of Dr. Qadri, who says, the ISIS ideology is kufr, it is anti-Islam, against the teachings of the Prophet of Islam. There's also the Marrakesh Declaration, the product of a global conference that brought together hundreds of major Muslim leaders, religious and political. And of course, the Genocide Initiative, which played a major role in the passing of the Fortenberry Resolution in the House of Representatives in March of 2016, in which the U.S. government condemned ISIS for war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity. So what am I saying? Get involved. Read the Covenants of the Prophet Muhammad with the Christians of the World. Sign the Covenants Initiative, the Genocide Initiative. If you're a scholar of Islam, sign a common word, the Amman Declaration, the letter to Baghdadi, and the various edicts against ISIS. Engage in interfaith work and interfaith work. Build bonds between Muslims, Christians, and Jews. Build bonds between Sunnis, Shiites, and Sufis. Build bonds as human beings, first and foremost. I have some very bad news for you. I am going to die. Please save your wailing, mourning, let me at it, matam for Ashura. I am not worthy. In any event, my doctor says I'm going to die. According to him, I have 30 or 40 years at most. Apparently, all human beings die. We have a 100% mortality rate. So whether it is today or 7 years from now, you will pass away, be buried, be resurrected, and be judged. So work to improve this world as if you would live forever, and work for the hereafter as if you are going to die tomorrow. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Thank you for your presentation, Dr. Barham. May Allah reward you, and may He protect you and your family. Without further ado, we will go to the second presentation, and then I will ask again our panelists, inshallah, a couple of questions of clarification, and then we will open ourselves up to, again, questions and or very brief comments from the audience. With that, I could call up Dr. Barnett. Are you ready? صلوا على محمد وآل محمد.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Well, while we're waiting, what Dr. Barrow says is very true, and keep in mind the hadith of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And nas a'da'u ma jahilu, that human beings are opponents or adversaries for what they don't know. And we're talking about positive steps. The best thing that we can do in eroding Islamophobia is to actually get people to know our humanity and to experience or taste the beauty of Islam through their personal interactions with us. But you know, as the saying goes, that, you know, empty words are just not enough, right? That we can talk about the beauty of Islam, but if the American people aren't seeing it in our akhlaq, in our adab, we can talk about the beauty of Islam all we want, but people, or as, I don't think I can use the saying anymore, because Bill Cosby messed it up, but the proof is in the pudding, right? Saying by Bill Cosby. Are we ready, Doctor?
Well, I can start talking and maybe...
Let's start talking now because you don't want to hear me.
Well, you can talk too.
Okay.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for inviting me here. I appreciate the courage of the organizers of this event who are willing to take on issues that intimidate many people, and especially Muslims in this time of systematic deception and a public relations war on Islam driven by false flag publicity stunts designed to incite fear and hatred of Islam at a very deep level of the mass mind and individual minds. And this issue is so terrifying to many people that they don't want to face it themselves. And it's so terrifying to the power structure that misgoverns the world in general, and this country in particular, that they have essentially let it be known that people who have a place at the table, people who are getting funding from foundations, people who are working with corporations, with government entities, had better not talk about these issues, or they will lose their place at the table. So it takes courage to take this on if you're an organization with substantial connections and attempting to make a difference in the world. And the Muslim Congress is very courageous, and I salute the Muslim Congress for that. My work since 2006, actually since 2004 really, has been focused on this issue of false flags and the deep state. The term false flag comes from the history of naval warfare, when ships would fly the flag of a different country so they could sneak up on a ship and attack it. And it's come to mean a kind of a horrifying event staged by someone other than the parties that are blamed for it in order to gain some kind of political advantage, often to launch a war. That's what the attack of September 11th was. It was designed to launch not just the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, it was designed to launch a war on Islam that would last for a century. We actually have the neoconservatives who are behind this talking about this and saying it's 100 years of war. And a few of them have even come out and admitted that it's 100 years of war on Islam. A certain Professor Shaul actually said that. He said, "I think that the Bush administration should have admitted what this war really is. It's a war on Islam." So, as Muslims, we need to be aware of this, and we need to fight back in the most effective way. And I think we can start out by helping expose the role of the deep state, which is the part of the power structure that's connected to the government, but it's not always officially the government, and its role in these events. And since 9/11 was so big and so powerful, that's a good place to start. 9/11 actually gave half the American population clinical post-traumatic stress disorder, according to studies cited by Dr. Martha Stout in her book, The Paranoia Switch. Think about it, half the population of this country was given clinical PTSD just from the images they saw on television that day. That's astounding. Usually soldiers get PTSD from witnessing horrific things and doing horrific things in wartime. But half the population, more than 150 million people here in the US and who knows how many hundreds of millions elsewhere, got PTSD just from looking at these images on television. And we now know that those images were produced specifically to create that effect. So this was a monumentally important event. And the fact that there's a controversy about it today, and many people, perhaps most people, suspect that they haven't gotten the full story about 9/11, is of tremendous importance. And if we can contribute to the gradual awakening to the truth about that, and the truth about this whole series of deceptions that preceded and followed 9/11, we can strike a very powerful blow against this Islamophobia and this distortion of our own deen of Islam that Dr. Morrow talked about so eloquently. Because not only are these events being staged as public relations stunts, but the entities behind them, so-called Al-Qaeda, so-called ISIS or Daesh, are essentially fabricated groups. These are not natural, spontaneous expressions of some weird form of Islam. Well, to some extent, maybe they are, a small extent. But they're primarily artificially constructed groups that represent what the enemies of Islam want people to think about Islam. So the simplest and quickest way to expose that is not so much to go into a long dialogue like we Islamic studies professors would be tempted to do, but it's rather to get somebody to actually sit down and look at a two-minute video about Building 7 on 9/11. How many people here know about Building 7? Half, almost. That's pretty good. It was a 47-story skyscraper that came down straight into the ground, like an elevator going straight into the ground at fully free-fall acceleration for the first couple of seconds and then virtual free-fall for the rest of the way. 6.5 seconds for this 47-story building to go straight down through the path of most resistance into the ground. Clearly, all of the structural supports, the columns holding this building up, had to disappear, completely disappear, and stop exerting any force whatsoever so that the entire building could come down with no resistance at all. And the word for that, of course, is controlled demolition. That's how buildings are removed, so they won't damage the buildings around them. Any natural building collapse is always slow, progressive, and massively asymmetrical, basically topple, right? So show people Building 7 coming down. Show them the mafia landlord who bought the World Trade Center complex 6 weeks before 9/11, certain Mr. Larry Silverstein. Show him confessing to the demolition of this building, which he did on national television. And show that he then collected billions of dollars, almost $5 billion of insurance money on these buildings. He'd only put down a little over $10 million of his own money for, $10 million. And he got almost $5 billion. And the towers had been full of asbestos and condemned for asbestos in 2001. Had those towers stood, Mr. Silverstein would have gone broke within a few months. But because they came down, he made billions of dollars in just a few minutes. So show people this information and let them draw the obvious conclusions. The obvious conclusions, of course, are that this was not at all what we've been told. So I got involved in this issue because 9/11 was so big and so clearly an arranged publicity stunt that the official version of it was so obviously false in every single respect. We got images. So let me shift gears real quickly. I got into this work through 9/11. On 9/11, nobody knew what the expression false flag meant, except for the military people who study them in the military academies. Today, it's a very popular meme. After the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris, it took me a little time to realize that this was a false flag. Not very much time. My article on this event quickly got more than 100,000 reads, and all of my articles on these subsequent false flag terror events have quickly soared into more than 100,000, in one case more than 500,000 reads. That means lots of people are aware of these events being frauds. Here we have, after the Charlie Hebdo attack, the world leaders were marching through the streets of Paris. We were told they were leading millions of people, but this is what it really looked like. There were a lot of people in the streets, but the world leaders were nowhere near them. It was a photo op, and they photoshopped it. Next slide. Netanyahu repeatedly threatened France right before the Charlie Hebdo attack, saying if France continues to side with the Palestinians, terror will come to your country. Next. And they voted to endorse the or to recognize Palestine, and the next thing, less than a month later, boom, this huge terror came to their country. It's obvious who did it. Here's the smoking gun, literally, proving that the Charlie Hebdo event was a false flag. Here we have the alleged terrorist supposedly shooting the policeman on the sidewalk. Go look at this video someday. What you'll see is that this AK-47 assault rifle, which would have blown his head apart had he actually been shot in the head, does not hit his head. Instead, a small puff of dust comes off the sidewalk. It was a blank round, it was cotton or paper, not an actual bullet. Had it been a bullet, it would have cratered the sidewalk. And the head, this man's head, the policeman who supposedly shot in the head from point-blank range, is completely unscathed. It's not even affected. It doesn't even move, and there's not a spot of blood anywhere. Obviously, this man is intentionally missing the policeman, shooting the sidewalk with a blank round. It is a staged publicity stunt, not an actual killing. And yet, to this day, the government of France and the world media insist that this policeman is being shot in the head, point-blank, from an AK-47. Next slide. We were told by the Interior Minister the only way that reason they caught the terrorists was because they dropped their ID cards and then a getaway card. That was very nice of the terrorists too, though, wasn't it? Next slide. Where did the terrorists drop off their car? Right in front of the extremist Zionist headquarters, essentially, of the Israeli Defense Forces. That's in the middle of the Jewish neighborhood of Paris. That's a weird place for Islamic terrorists to go to change cars. Next slide. Here we're told that Coulibaly, the terrorist, is being shot by police after he has held hostages in a kosher deli, but he's handcuffed. Okay? The official story is the police heroically rescued the hostages. In reality, this guy was sacrificed. He was handcuffed, thrown on the ground in front of the window, and the police then shot him when he was helpless. Totally not what the official story says. Next. Coulibaly, the guy you just saw being shot in handcuffs, was an old operator. He worked for the Sarkozy campaigns. Sarkozy is Netanyahu's frontman in the French government. Next. The night of the Charlie Hebdo attacks, the honest police officer who was investigating the truth about the case was found dead in his office at 1 a.m. with a bullet in the head. He had said that he had discovered really crucial information. He would be up all night. He called his family, said he couldn't come home. His superior officer ordered him off the case. He refused. And the next thing you know, he's dead in his office with a bullet in the head. And today, the French government still insists that it's a suicide. His family knows otherwise. Next. He was investigating the man behind the Charlie Hebdo magazine, this guy, Charlotte, and Jeanette Bougrab, who said she was his basically common-law wife. That was a lie. All of Sharp's friends, after she went in the newspaper saying she was his family, they all said she's lying. They wouldn't let her come to the funeral. She also is an agent of Sarkozy and Netanyahu, and she was funneling money to keep that magazine alive as it was setting up the Islamophobic provocations to lead to this fake terror event. Next. So I wrote about this in We Are Not Charlie Hebdo. It includes more than 20 leading public intellectuals telling the truth about this event. Next slide. Then in November, on the very day I was passing through Paris, yet another false flag happened. Which day was it? Well, here we have, this is from the cover of The Economist magazine that was published in late 2014. The Economist magazine was telling us what was going to happen in 2015. Well, look what they told us was going to happen the year before it happens. Two attacks in France. People would be in an Alice in Wonderland through the looking glass world and not know what really happened. And what's the date? Unscramble these numbers. The only way to make any date in 2015 out of these numbers is 11-13-15. Or in the European style, 13-11-15. That is, those numbers can only make one date, November 13th, 2015. They were telling us what they were going to do in 2015. Next. This is the cover. Go ahead. So, once again, the so-called terrorists dropped their patent. The authorities admit that it was planted, a fake ID is used to implicate the Patsies. Next. There was a drill mimicking exactly what happened on the same day. Just like on 9-11. On 9-11, there were 46 drills, including 25 happening that day, including live flight plane into building exercises. On July 7, 2005, the drills mimicked exactly the times and places of the bombs going off. And we have a televised confession to that. Once again here, exactly the same drills. Next. Here was the 7-7 confession to those drills. Next. And the 46 drills of 9-11. Next. These Patsies, these ISIS people they blame for this, are working for the intelligence agencies, crossing borders at will, and generally being set up and or helped. Next. Large white paramilitaries have carried out several shootings blamed on Muslims. That was true in Paris. It was also true in San Bernardino, where multiple witnesses, three different witnesses all reported, three large white paramilitaries did the shooting in San Bernardino that's been blamed on a dark-skinned Muslim couple, including a woman who's about very, very small. Next. So the result of this is endless propaganda for war, especially in Islamic countries, the destruction of civil liberties, massive money for the military-industrial complex, and the destruction of Israel's enemies in the Middle East, which is what the reason they created ISIS, the reason they overthrew, destroyed Iraq, destroyed Libya, destroyed Syria. And that's what this is all a public relations campaign for. So let's fast forward on through towards the end, skip a bunch of these slides. Keep going. Okay, so stop. So what is ISIS? Who does ISIS kill? We're told that ISIS is radical Muslims killing non-Muslims, but the reality is that 99% of ISIS's victims are Muslims. This is part of the war on Islam. This has nothing to do with Islam. So continue. And everybody knows this in Iraq. Next. They're giving us staged beheading videos. The site intelligence group, Rita Katz, a Israeli Mossad agent, is the publicist for ISIS. All of these fake beheading videos, and some real ones probably, that ISIS does commit atrocities, it's all coming through the Mossad. It's all coming through Rita Katz. Continue. Oh, well. This was the only picture of any dead bodies after the Paris attack. It was tweeted into existence by Israelis linked to a hard right Islamophobic neocon Zionist group here in the US. What a bizarre picture. They smeared a heart there on the floor of the Bataclan Theater in blood. Next slide. And guess what? That was a sign that their next attack was going to be at the Brussels airport. Can you believe the audacity of these people? I mean, this makes no sense. Why would there be a heart smeared in blood on the floor? Where are the doctors? Where are the emergency workers? Where are the police? What, this photo is very bizarre. What does it mean? That's what it means. We're going to hit the Brussels airport next. And they did. Okay, I think I've just about hit the end of my allotted time. So let's just, here, we'll stop here. These are my two books on the two French false flags of 2015. And I have a third book on Orlando coming out. It's actually available now through Amazon. But I haven't yet even been able to get a copy myself, so you can go ahead and buy it through Amazon, and you'll have a copy almost as soon as I do. So the books I do have, I have them out at the table, and I'd be happy to discuss this with you and answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Doctor. I have two questions to pose to the panelists, and then we will go to the audience. And both of you have given a lot of evidence, a lot of statistics. Dr. Morrow gave a plethora of sources stating that Islamic scholars, Islamic institutions have denounced terrorism, have denounced extremism, as well as he gave a number of other stats. And you also showed some very clear evidence there in terms of some glaring inconsistencies, as well as that 99% of extremist victims are actually Muslims. How do we actually begin to change public opinion, given that most people don't get moved by statistics, they get moved by emotions? And we know this from the Donald Trump campaign. He can lie through his teeth. He has no reason, no logic. And when people come with all sorts of statistics, then Donald Trump just says, make America great again, let's build the wall, kick a mother out of a rally with a baby, and just say all types of ridiculous stuff, and people cheer him on. So we know that people get moved more off of emotions than actual statistics. So if you can just give some examples of like, what do you think we can do to basically take this information to basically sway people emotionally?
I think we should be active at every level of society. As I mentioned, we need to put Islamic values and ethics into practice. Actions speak louder than words. I could mention several inspiring cases. There was an instance in which an African-American church was burned to the ground, and Muslims came, and they raised over $100,000 to rebuild it. there was a similar case in the Toronto area of Muslims coming to the rescue, coming to the help of their fellow Christian neighbors in order to help rebuild churches that have been destroyed. And we find that when we reach out to people that way, they also reach out to us. Many of you know that protests, armed protests against Muslims were organized all over the United States by these bikers and so on and these Islamophobes. These are people who came armed to the teeth looking for trouble. And who came out to protect these churches, these mosques? The Christians, our friends who are Christians, came out and they stood side by side with the Muslims and said, "You will not touch this mosque." And instead of responding aggressively to these people, the Muslims invited them in. And you know, they greeted them warmly, and they offered them tea, and they said, "Can we give you a tour of the mosque?" And some of these people came around, and they went from being rabid Islamophobes to sympathizers of Islam. And there are also some cases of some of these protesters who actually ended up embracing Islam. And so there are many other cases like this. I know in one African American neighborhood, after 9/11, there was lots of hostility towards Muslims, but the people there were, there was an African-American Muslim group in the neighborhood, and they were very active, people running soup kitchens and so on, doing social work. And so when people would start, insulting Islam and Muslims and saying they're terrorists, they said, that Bin Laden guy, he's not the same type of Muslim as these brothers from down the block. And so, yes, we have to reach out to people, we have to open our mosques, we have to talk to people, and that's how we're going to win people over.
Yeah, I think we need to change the frame. There's a book called Don't Think of an Elephant by George Lakoff that points out that if you tell somebody, "Don't think of an elephant," what do they think of? They think of an elephant, right? Likewise, if we say Muslims are not terrorists, all they hear, people hear, is Muslim terrorists. If we say Muslims hate ISIS, unfortunately, they hear Muslims ISIS, because they're stuck in a narrative framework that was created by these false flag publicity stunts. And to get them out of it, I do know that some will come out of this for various reasons, but we really need, rather than so much to work within the narrative framework that's been imposed on us by the media, by the enemies of Islam, We need to tell a better story, and our own story. So I think telling the story of the truth about the war, so-called war on terror, which is really a war on Islam, is actually more effective than these various other approaches that allow the people who stage these publicity stunts to continue to tell their story. We cannot accept that story. If you accept the story that Al-Qaeda, a radical Muslim group, attacked the U.S. on 9/11, you've already lost the argument, and Islamophobia will just keep getting worse and worse and worse until we're all in concentration camps. You have to stand up and contest that narrative and say, "No, that was the enemies of Islam that blew up the World Trade Center and murdered those 3,000 Americans that day, and they've done every one of these other spectacular attacks since." Not to mention the ones before, the African embassy bombings, the USS Cole, they did all of those. You need to say that. But more importantly, to make that emotionally acceptable to people, I think, we need to point out that this is actually good news. It sounds scary, it sounds like bad news, but it's really good news. Why? Because it shows that Islam is right, and certain varieties of Christianity are wrong, not to mention certain kinds of Judaism, that people are born pure of heart. We come from God, and to God we return. We're not utterly and completely corrupted by original sin. No, no, people are basically good. They're born okay. And then they get corrupted. And a lot of Christians and other people today who are not Muslims kind of get this. Well, the only reason that people can be whipped up into homicidal hysteria and support war and oppression is by these big lies. Because otherwise they won't. If they said, "Let's go murder 4 million Muslims in Iraq and Afghanistan and destroy all these governments and turn these countries into chaos, let's just go do that, steal some resources and make the neighborhood better for Israel," the American people would have said no. So they had to stage a publicity stunt so they can say, "Radical Muslims are attacking the United States. We must defend ourselves and go kill 4 million Muslims." This means that the American people are basically decent. They're basically good. And throughout history, the people who want war and oppression have to lie to people to get the war on oppression. By exposing these lies, we make it harder and harder for them to keep lying to people and getting people to support these evil things. This is a very positive message once you get through the fear that keeps you from getting into it. Once you get into it, you can explain that we can actually greatly reduce the amount of oppression in the world, and we can greatly reduce, if not eliminate, war by telling the truth about this, not only these individual events, but the larger narrative that people are basically good, and they will not aggress, and they will not kill unless they are lied to. That's good news.
Thank you both. The second and last question I'll pose before we open it up is, do you think there's ever a time or place where American Muslims should use respectability politics to counter Islamophobia? And so the example, just for the audience to use, respectability politics, is like saying, let's wave the flag of patriotism and show the broader society, we're just like you, and if we're just like you, then we think that's going to cut down on Islamophobia. Like two Thursdays ago at the Democratic National Convention, where the brother gets up and talks about how his son was killed as a war hero in Iraq, even though we know that war was based upon lies, it was an illegal invasion, there were war crimes set up, and the U.S. military was killing Muslims.
Okay, well, I'm the disrespectable guy, so I'll say, no, to heck with him, to Jehennem with respectability politics. I mean, because that's where you're going to end up if you follow that path of compromise. The deen of Islam began with speaking truth to power, right? And nobody knows this better than the Shia community, which, you know, some of my Shia friends say, hey, we're the truthers of Islam. And I have to admit that they may have a point to a certain extent anyway. So you have to be able to stand up and tell the truth. And if respectability means endorsing lies and mass murder, then it's not worth it. And I don't think it's effective either. When bullies beat you up, if you try to kowtow to them and, you know, kiss their feet, then they just keep on beating you up. You gotta kick them back. You know, I'm not saying go out and aggress against them and their families and everything. No, you just have to fight back to stop the bullying. You know, I learned this personally, and I've only been in a couple of fights in my life of standing up to bullies, and it works. So respectability in that sense is not respectable in the eyes of God, and we can't do it.
Well, I do believe it's important to engage and to have a seat at the table, but if you're seeking patronage from these people, that's when it becomes very problematic.
Yeah, being respectable is one thing. Taking money from the bad guys is another thing.
We'll take the first question. You can take the microphone to them and you'll turn the camera, or do you want them to come here?
I'll just have the camera on them the entire
time. Okay. I think we can hear everyone this year, but they'll pass the microphone around. First question. Does anyone have a question? Yes, I do. Yeah. Go ahead. Please say it.
Probably my question is addressed for both Dr. Merwa and Dr. Barad. Well, mostly Dr. Barad, because you exposed that Charlie Hebdo event. And my question is, what is the interest of the French government to promote Islamophobia? Is that a ticket in Europe to push the right wing to the power, or what is the purpose behind that? What is the intention?
That's a great question, and there are many ways to approach that. One is, why is France getting hit with all of these huge false flags? Charlie Hebdo, November 13th, and now this Nice truck false flag, which I wrote about in my latest book. Why France? And I love France. I lived there for a year. I speak passable French. It pains me to see France being attacked this way. I think there are a number of reasons, beginning with the history of France. France is a good place to bash Muslims. because everybody there is predisposed, not everybody, but people there are predisposed to buy into Islamophobia, because there are two main identitarian currents in France. One is the old Catholic France Profonde, and that was created. The notion of France and the notion of Europe were created in wars against Islam, against Islam in Spain. So they're already, and their whole identity is based on being against Islam. And then the second major current is this arch-secularist current of the French Revolution. And they hate religion. The French revolutionaries, they raped nuns, they cut the throats of priests, sort of like ISIS. That was going on in France 200 years ago. So the arch-secularists there have a very anti-religious tradition. So between those two groups, which are the two main political, historical schools in France, everybody there is predisposed to hate Islam. So you can basically tell them any story you want, stage some atrocity, tell them Muslims did it, and they're going to tend to believe it because they're predisposed to that. That's part of it. But also, I think there's a struggle in France between hardcore neocon Zionists, the Sarkozy faction, and other folks in France who are turning against hardline Zionism and are much more reasonable. And that would even include some traditionalists like Chirac, who opposed the Iraq War. So there's an internal struggle there, just like in the United States. And just as 9/11 was a hardline Zionist neoconservative coup d'etat in the United States, likewise, these events are part of an ongoing hardline neocon Zionist coup d'etat within France. They're trying to stop the movement to support Palestine in France. They slaughtered kids at the Bataclan to turn this demographic of the young people who are supporting Palestine against Islam. So these are all among the reasons I think that they're targeting France. There are more, but Elias, would you like to add more?
Well, what you say is true. I mean, the French are raised on stories of La Chanson de Roland and so on, and these medieval wars against the Muslims and so on. But there was a period of time in which the French were friends and allies of the Muslims. There was something known as the Franco-Ottoman Alliance, which was inspired by the covenant of the Prophet Muhammad with the Christians of the World, which was published in France in 1630. For centuries, the French and the Ottomans were on good terms. Unfortunately, things changed when France went from being a Catholic country to a secular nation. And so when Napoleon invaded Egypt, and when the French started invading, attacking, and colonizing North Africa, they no longer had any interest in abiding by this covenant of the Prophet. And so you'll find that during this period of time, all the French scholars and so on and the politicians were saying, yes, the covenant of the Prophet, it's authentic. But when they decided to become imperialists and colonizers and so on, it became very convenient for them to say, no, it's a forgery, because they had no intention of respecting the rights of Muslims.
Well, as you explained, there is so much Islamophobia, and you were saying 9/11 was a false flag and all that. At the same time, we see President Obama giving speeches in the favor of Islam. How do you balance out Islamophobia in that sense? Like, but he's speaking up for Islam on the media.
I want to make a comment about this real quick. I'm going to take moderator's privilege. Malcolm X famously said, he made a comparison with two animals, the wolf and the fox. And he said that being a farm boy, he said that you want to protect your chicken coop. And then you have a wolf that can eat your chickens, and you have a fox that can eat your chickens. The only difference is the wolf howls. The fox is quiet and will subtly try to come to eat your chickens, right? And he said he actually preferred the wolf over the fox, because you're better to guard your chicken coop from the wolf than the fox. So President Obama may say some nice things about Muslims and Islam, but at the end of the day, he is the commander-in-chief of the imperialist state of America. And he has as much as much as he said nice things, if you look at the amount of drone attacks that have gone to Somalia and Pakistan and Yemen that have killed civilians, you'll see that Obama has killed more Muslims with drone strikes than Bush. If you look at in the American Muslim community, as far as the suspected terrorist watch list, the no-fly list, the infiltration of Masajid by FBI informants and agents, you'll see this has gotten worse under the nice-talking Obama, who has Muslims in his family, than President Bush. So this is a case of, we have a fox now, before we had a wolf.
Yeah, I can't improve on that much. I don't think the fox here is purposely necessarily wants to be that much of a fox. I think that's just what the role demands. And I do think there's a sector of the American power structure that's partly sort of represented by some of Obama's advisors that is not particularly enthusiastic about this neocon Zionist war on Islam. They would rather pivot to China and deal with Russia. So it's a complex situation, but I think you summed it up pretty well.
There's a brother right there, then I have a written question, then you, sister. Go ahead, brother.
So I have a question that in your lective, you presented the proactives and signatures of, you know, the spear of blood, and that was basically meant for the Brussels Airport. Similarly, you know, some of the Hollywood movies have talked in the 60s about the 9/11, and, you know, so likewise, there are other prophecies and all those, you know, signatures are being coming. For example, there's a Simpson clip on YouTube that talks about Donald Trump will be a president. So how to counter these type of proactive signatures which are meant for something? Is there, you know, that is because that will probably proactive signatures, if we can able to prevent them from happening by reacting immediately rather than waiting and saying, oh, they have shown the signature and now we are proving it. So everything comes out later, not immediately. So,
yeah, that's a good point. There are many, many examples of this so-called predictive programming. And just feed that into your search engine and look at some videos. You'll see clear predictive programming of 9/11 on The Simpsons. That's an undeniable one. And you'll also see the Lone Gunman episode aired before a couple of months before 9/11 of a remotely guided plane going into the Twin Towers, which was, of course, exactly what happened on 9/11. On and on, there are dozens of these examples. So the question becomes, can we intercept this and stop it? Well, many people have tried, but one of the problems, though, is that there's so many possible cases where you could point to, maybe this is predicting this kind of attack, that you start sounding like the John Nash, the guy who was the subject of A Beautiful Mind, a crazy conspiracy theorist who thinks that they're gonna hit this and they're gonna hit that. So if you go too far in that direction, you start looking irrational, but every now and then you still have to do it, in my opinion. And it all depends on just how clear it looks in the individual case. And I just did this recently with, we were expecting a possible attack on the Eiffel Tower based on a number of indicators, including the fact that after the Brussels airport attack, that there were photos put out of the damage of the Brussels attack showing the Eiffel Tower on its side. There was a big sculpture of the Eiffel Tower in a cafe at the Brussels airport. And they went and staged a lot of that destruction at the Brussels airport. The Big Bang was actually just a bang bomb. It wasn't a real bomb. And it looks like they may have used crisis actors, etc. In any case, they knocked down this Eiffel Tower sculpture and photographed it on its side as an example of the damage in Brussels. So Holy Damagard, a fellow researcher, said to me, you know, they're going to probably not have ISIS knock down the Eiffel Tower. And so we sort of put out, if this happens, you know, they told us they were going to do it, right? And then Oli was actually expecting it to happen right about in the middle of June. And then, guess what actually happened? The Nice truck attack. And on the same day that the Nice truck attack happened, there was smoke was pouring out and obscuring the Eiffel Tower. They claimed that something caught fire at the Eiffel Tower. So they had these photos of smoke billowing up from the Eiffel Tower as some kind of accident happening the same day as the Nice truck attack. So Ole and I wonder whether we saved the Eiffel Tower. And actually this a former Algerian intelligence guy who reports to me on France, told me that he thinks that they might have been planning to knock down the Eiffel Tower, and then they went to plan B in Nice with that truck attack, because people had heard about this. And so then they kind of signaled the Eiffel Tower thing with the smoke bombs on the same day. I don't know if that's the case, so maybe we saved the Eiffel Tower by doing exactly what you're suggesting. But again, you have to be kind of careful with this and only talk about it when there's a fairly clear piece of evidence that makes some sense, otherwise you sound irrational.
Question for Dr. Morrow, and then we'll get to yours, sister. We'll get to yours next after this. We are trying to do more social work, but we don't get media coverage for that, so how can we change the impression of common Americans without mainstream media help?
It's extremely, extremely difficult, as you can imagine. So essentially, it has to be a grassroots effort. It has to be bottom up. And eventually, if you keep putting on the pressure and so on, some of this will get reported. But it's going to be difficult. If you go back several decades, there were thousands of independent media outlets, and gradually they were all bought up and they were consolidated into a few hands. So most of the media is controlled by three or four companies. So yes, it's very one-sided. It's Dajjalian.
So we have to support alternative media, support truth-telling media. Complain if there's a hotel, I don't know about this one, or an airport or a public place that's showing Fox News or even CNN. Tell them you want Press TV, right? Everywhere you go, every hotel you stay at, tell them you want Press TV. And if they're playing Fox, tell them that this is racist propaganda that's unacceptable, it shouldn't be broadcast in public. So stand up for Press TV, they're doing a really good job. And also support the rest of the independent truth-telling media. Any media outlet that's telling the truth about the war on terror, the kinds of things I'm talking about, deserves your support, especially if it's doing it in a reasonable, rational way, not a way that looks bad. And there are lots of outlets like that. And the mainstream is losing money, losing audience. The alternative truth-telling media is gaining audience. Like I said, I had hundreds and hundreds of thousands of reads for all of my articles on these false flags. Lots of people are interested. You know, Veterans Today, the alternative outlet I work for, it's as big as some of the mainstream outlets. So help push the alternative media right up there with the establishment media.
We have sister right here, and then this brother, and then it's probably going to be, we'll see. I see the other hands, but we only have 9 minutes left. Go ahead, sister.
Yes, this question is for Dr. Morrow. He mentioned how 7%
Well, yes, it's definitely a huge problem. 7%, of course, is an average. In some countries, the support for ISIS is much higher. And so they conducted surveys in many Muslim countries, and it ended up being about 7% who support them. Unfortunately, you know, if you ask further questions, you know, how many people of you agree with their ideology, which is this Salafi Wahhabi ideology, you will find that that percentage grows significantly. And as I was mentioning in my presentation, this is a huge challenge for us. This level of ignorance, this level of fanaticism, and how can we explain that? Well, there was a point in which you would be hard-pressed to find even a small Muslim girl who was illiterate in the Muslim world. However, after colonialism, the rate of literacy dropped. So we went from almost complete literacy in the Muslim world to almost complete illiteracy. The traditional Islamic educational system was completely destroyed. This created a vacuum. And unfortunately, all of this coincides with the rise of the Kingdom of Saud, created, of course, by the British, who supported these Takfiri Wahhabi jihadis, you know, Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab's people, used them to overthrow the Ottoman Empire, to destroy Islam as a political power in the world. And so they have estates, and oil is discovered, and they make an enormous amount of money and so on, and what do they use it for? They use it to disseminate this ideology, okay? This is not traditional civilizational Islam. It is a cult, right? This is a heretical group. And so what happens is they start using their money to spread this ideology across the Muslim world by means of books and so on, by means of universities, the universities in Saudi Arabia, but also many of the Islamic universities throughout the Muslim world that are funded and controlled by these very same people disseminating this ideology. And so there was a vacuum created, and it was filled by these people who spread Salafism far and wide. So, you know, it's very difficult. It is very difficult.
Well, I would add that that 7% sounds bad, but if you actually think about it, you can get 7% of people to endorse an awful lot of things if you word your poll properly. And secondly, think about where is that coming from. Okay, the majority of Muslims in polls say they would like to see a unified Islamic state, like a caliphate, right? Two-thirds of Muslims worldwide want to unite the Muslim majority countries into one entity. So if you say we're for Islamic state, that phrase is going to click with Muslims. And it's actually wonderful that the 93% realize that ISIS or Daesh is phony. So that's one thing. The second thing is that the West is waging war on Islam, has murdered 4 million Muslims, is staging these outrageous false flags, brutally oppressing people everywhere, especially Muslims. And so ISIS or Daesh, they look like they're sort of fighting back. Now, obviously, in an incredibly stupid way, in a totally incredibly counterproductive way, if we're sophisticated. But I'm not surprised that that, you know, 7% or the small minority of people aren't sophisticated enough to see that. So how do we stop this? Number one, we say, yeah, the idea of uniting Muslims is good, but let's do it reasonably and rationally. And number two, let's say, yeah, fighting back against the imperialists and the Zionists is good, but let's do it in the most effective way, which is with truth, not by running around staging beheadings for the Israeli Mossad to put on television.
A last question with 3 minutes left. Go ahead.
So my question is related to an earlier question, which was the signature and the predictability of things to happen. Now, as in San Bernardino, the three tall white guys in a black SUV is pretty hard to predict. This is my first question is, who were they?
It's the only question.
No, like it's A and B. So who were they? Were they Mossad agents? Were they locals? Were they hitmen? Were they paid guys? I mean, now we know a thing has happened, and what can we do now? And secondly, if we need a cover-up for an operation like this, let's say for the Mossad operation, titled Operation A, we need somebody higher than a police chief, I mean bigger in stature, to cover it up. Now, local institutions are involved in it, if that is the case. So I would like to like answers from both of you.
Okay, the new book I have out called Orlando False Flag is a great resource for answering that question. It includes a couple of essays, one by Gordon Duff, a former CIA agent, who says that the privatization of militaries and intelligence black operations services to create these G4S, which Omar Mateen worked for, Wackenhut is another name for that, Blackwater, Chris Kyle's group that staged the Boston Marathon attacks, these privatized entities that work together with corrupt government officials are probably responsible for much of this mayhem. And then organized crime, which is also not really that different from some of these groups, is also a paradigm that we can use to understand this. If we understand that the New York Police Department, when Serpico was working, was all on the take, they were all working for the mafia, that the top level of the FBI is still that way, that the head of the Boston FBI was out, he murdered dozens of people for the mafia. We understand that the police departments of the United States all have CIA infiltrators working with the, inside the police departments. When Governor Jesse Ventura took over in Minnesota, he was led down to the basement of the state capitol where he met the 24 CIA people with cover jobs in the state government, including the police, who really run Minnesota, asking him how in the world he got elected as an independent, and debriefing him. We understand that all of these criminal organizations and intelligence organizations plant people all over the place and work with privatized spinoffs and criminal cartels, and they're able to pull this stuff off, and there isn't yet enough of a public outcry to force the authorities to solve these cases, and we need a public outcry.
Thank you very much. The two panelists, I think, will be around, inshallah, after this right here. If you have any one-on-one questions or want to know more about their writings, they're both prolific authors. With that, please make dua for our brothers, that Allah Azza wa Jalla protects them, anyone who's involved in challenging the status quo and or is telling the truth. We know that there are people who don't like truth. The people of Fadl do not like the people of Haqq. So we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to protect both of you and protect your families. إن الله وملائكته يصلون على النبي يا أيها الذين آمنوا صلوا عليه وسلموا تسليما.